I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon, the day before the next Democratic debate, which will be held in Milwaukee and televised on PBS and heard on Wisconsin Public Radio. This day, we talk about yesterday's New Hampshire primary. Let me just give you the numbers. Bernie Sanders, 144,391 votes, 60% of the New Hampshire electorate. Hillary Clinton, 92,191 votes, 38.3% of the vote. On the Republican side, Donald Trump, 97,188 votes, 35.3% of the vote. John Kasich, number two, 43,414 votes with 15.8% of the Republican voters. Ted Cruz came in at 11.5% and Jeb Bush at 11% of the votes. Obviously, a very large win for Bernie Sanders. We'll talk about what that means, if it's just a fluke or if he has struck something with the electorate that his idealism is resonating. Does it point to some very profound difficulties in the Clinton campaign, or is it just that we have yet to move to states that have a more diverse electorate? In terms of Donald Trump, there is news that Chris Christie will probably be dropping out sometime today. We'll talk about his large win in New Hampshire yesterday and whether or not he could be the Republican nominee. We have two guests with us for this hour, and we'll invite your phone calls. We'd love to hear from you, as you, like many of us, spent most of the night listening to the returns from New Hampshire. Jill Lawrence is with us. Jill is the commentary editor of USA Today. She's a former columnist for U.S. News and World Report. She is the author of the Brookings Institution's Profile in Negotiations series and a contributor to The Surge, 2014's big GOP win and what it means for the next presidential race. She co-authored Governors and the Presidency, How They Campaign, How They Govern. And we're delighted to have her with us this hour. Hi, Jill. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's good to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you. Also joining us is Dan DeSalvo. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and associate professor of political science in the Colin Powell School at the City College of New York. And his special scholarship on American political parties, elections, labor unions, state government, and public policy. He writes frequently for The Weekly Standard, The LA Times, New York Daily News, New York Post, and other publications. And Dan, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Let's start with you, Jill, and look at both sides. Big wins, really substantial win for Bernie Sanders. I think the Hillary camp must have thought that the percentage wasn't going to be quite that high at some point. What does that say? And Donald Trump, also a resounding victory. Two guys who, you know, not that long ago, people would have said, are you serious?
Well, I think a lot of people are still saying that, actually.
Are they?
it's really quite a phenomenon, what's going on here. I mean, I personally figured Hillary Clinton might lose by about 10 points, and that would have been bad enough. I mean, remember, this is the state that saved her last time.
Right.
In 2008. She couldn't have continued without that victory, I don't think. Here, I think, you know, if it had been a small loss, then people would have said, okay, she's going on to other states that are more hospitable to her. This is just a blip. The magnitude of the loss, I think, has a lot of people wondering if there are some course corrections she can make. And the problem is that I don't know how far that will take her. The problem may be her as a candidate, mm-hmm. and her history and her baggage. So, you know, it's so striking that she lost women and lost young women very big, 7 in 10 under 45, I believe the exit poll showed. So it's big, big problems. How fundamental they are, I guess we'll see. You know, the question on both of sides of the equation is whether people in South Carolina and Nevada and the Super Tuesday states on March 1st are going to say, wow, these guys must be really good. Let's look into them, and maybe they pick up some support, or they say, wow, you know, I can't believe this happened and I need to help stop it.
Mm-hmm. And on the Republican side, Donald Trump, a very large victory for him. Who would have thought that some months ago, Dan?
Very few people. The ongoing question is whether people are long or short on Trump, but he continues to stick around, and now he has a real victory with real voters, and a quite striking one. And for the rest of the party, they were in some ways unable to consolidate around the sort of lane of the, let's say, more establishment candidate, for lack of a better way to put it. Rubio fell in the polls after a poor debate performance, and so you ended up with, really three candidates competing for that position inside the party against the more insurgent candidates of Cruz and Trump. So things don't look any clearer, I think, for the Republican side after New Hampshire than they did going in. It still looks very uncertain as to who will emerge as the eventual nominee.
Yes. What does it say about all of us? I'd like for both of you to respond to this. But, Jill, there's something going on with people being very upset, people wanting, on the one hand, an idealism and a change in the way business is done in this country. And that's true probably when you look at both of these candidates, even though they couldn't be more different ideologically. Everybody's kind of fed up. We want something different, very different.
Well, it's interesting that they've chosen the two most confrontational candidates that are running. Problems in Washington seem to be due to too much confrontation, and maybe, you know, there is kind of the strongman philosophy. There was somebody who studied Trump supporters and found out that they all had an affinity for authoritarianism. Mm. I don't think that's the same situation exactly with Bernie Sanders, but it is he does have very uncompromising principles, and his career belies the idea that he would not compromise, because he is a politician. He has been compromising for many decades, but he is very clear and gutsy in the way he expresses things that he believes are wrong with the economy and the country and the political system, and he has a lot of support on that front in both parties, I would think.
It is amazing when you look at his biography and you have a 74-year-old, he's not very young, he seems pretty vigorous, but he's not very young, Democratic socialist who is captivating particularly young Democratic voters, but he's really captivating a lot of Democratic voters, and he's a Democratic socialist. Isn't that interesting?
Well, I had a really interesting conversation with my dad about that, actually, who is older than Bernie Sanders and remembers that kind of rhetoric from the Cold War, and he's very turned off by it. But the younger voters don't have those memories. To them it sounds idealistic, I guess, and they like the things he's proposing, which are not all that radical in the scheme of things.
Right. And when it comes to Donald Trump, I still don't fully understand this phenomenon, Dan. He doesn't seem to, everything seems to be kind of off the cuff with him. I was amazed by his acceptance speech last night. It was, thanking everybody and we'll win this and we're going to be better than ever, and very few specifics, just these grand statements. It's not as though he's giving voters a lot of information about how he would lead the country, or am I reading this wrong?
I think you're reading it right, and I think many people are still amazed and don't have a good grasp on the Trump phenomenon. A few things that I think could be said are, first, as Jill mentioned, there is a lot of economic stagnation, especially, let's say, for middle class and lower middle class white Americans. That's a big slice of Trump supporters, many of whom are, don't follow politics closely. And Trump can make promises, and in that sense, even though it's vague and hazy and mainly bound up with the word great, Trump right. is sort of offering this promise or this vision that's going to make the country better. And for these voters that have seen a lot of stagnation in their income, haven't seen a lot of change, and are fearful of change, they're fearful of competition from immigrants from Latin America and elsewhere, this has a kind of appeal, it seems, and those voters are very much fluctuating. They used to have, 30 or 40 years ago, probably would have been members of labor unions and voted for Democrats. But as private sector unions have been declined, those voters have been detached. And this is a new constituency that really wasn't in the Republican Party before, and nobody had really capitalized on it or knows quite what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And in some sense, it's a little bit like Sanders, and this revealed, I think, New Hampshire did, some of Hillary's weaknesses, which is Sanders, whatever one thinks of the vision, he's at least offering a vision or a bold set of promises. It may be progressive or it may be taking us to Sweden in 1965, but it's a vision, and in that respect, it differs from Hillary, who seems much more incremental. The ultimate ends may not be that different, but she seems so much more prudent and cautious, and that doesn't especially lead to compelling or inspiring rhetoric, and that may be a problem for her going forward.
How important is this, and I'm not sure what the numbers are for Trump on this, but the trust numbers when it comes to Bernie Sanders are so much higher than what Hillary Clinton receives. Is that an important factor, and what does that mean, do you think, Jill, that voters trust him?
Well, Hillary Clinton has a lot of problems, some of which she created for herself, that have been giving many Democrats fits. You know, the whole email mess, the fundamental misjudgment of having a private server, the whole sense of entitlement, and I don't want to abide by the same public record and archiving and freedom of information laws that everyone else has to. It's just kind of an amazing situation, and Democrats have made their bed and now they've got to lie in it unless they're ready to go with Bernie Sanders. So in these numbers, you know, when push comes to shove, she's going to be running against somebody. Assuming she gets the nomination, she'll be running against somebody who won't be as pure as the driven snow. And so, you know, it'll all be relative. And at that point, you know, somebody may think, well, I don't trust her, but I do trust her to name people I agree with to the Supreme Court. Or I don't trust her, but she's not going to get rid of all of Barack Obama's executive orders on day one. So, I mean, other things may come into play, but it is an obstacle. It definitely is.
And you say, assuming she becomes the nominee, do you assume she will be?
If we're going by electoral politics, I would say yes, because I think she has a stronger organization and she is stronger with minorities and some of the people that are the core of the base. Now the FBI may have something to say about it. Who knows?
Right. And what about the trust factor when it comes to Donald Trump? Does that make a difference to Republican voters? Did they think about whether or not they trust him, Dan?
Yeah, trust didn't play, at least in the New Hampshire exit polls issue, didn't seem to play as big a role as it did on the Democratic side. More, I think, voters who cared about specific issues that Trump has really brought to the foreground were motivated to vote for him, which included especially reducing immigration and barring Muslims from immigrating to the United States, and some of his, say, hawkish or tough posturing when it came to foreign policy on ISIS. So I think those kind of things, those kind of bold truth-telling, I think Trump's version of this, where people liked in the exit polls, they liked Trump because he could tell it like it is.
Right.
In that respect, it's one of the most fascinating parts of the Trump phenomenon is political correctness used to be confined to academia, where I work, but now it's become a subject of a presidential campaign somehow raised by Trump as people feel constrained to say what they truly think. So this Trump being seen as kind of a truth teller and his frankness is seen as a virtue by some voters.
What about his crudeness?
That one would have thought under the older rules of political etiquette that this would have hurt Trump. And this is, I think, part of the phenomenon of Trump that many people are still trying to grapple with and understand, which is a kind of coarsening of political rhetoric and a sort of a lack of dignity in campaigning, even though American campaigns are famous for being, you know, hard-fought and tough and with lots of harsh words. But Trump has really taken things, I think many people see it as, to a new low, but it hasn't hurt him. And some people sort of see that as part of his frankness and appeal, oddly enough.
Why do you think it hasn't hurt him, Jill?
I can't believe it still won't hurt him. I mean,
really?
The way he behaves is the way no one would bring up their children, unless we have a whole segment of the population now seeing him as a role model for their families, which would really be unfortunate. So, it's been very shocking to me. The other thing that's been shocking is the way he has been so out of step on certain GOP, you know, conservative tenets, like, for instance, eminent domain. I mean, who would have thought he would win New Hampshire so big after his stirring defense of eminent domain and taking of property, and yet, as he put it himself, he could shoot somebody and he'd still, his polls would go up.
Right. Dan, you were about to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think Jill's right in this. I don't think people are paying more, it's the tone and style of Trump, rather than anything that he says in particular that people are applying to it. It's the sort of posturing almost more than is the specific words, but I can't believe that, you know, in some respects, I mean, some people have sort of argued that Trump is really running what's basically a third-party campaign inside the Republican presidential field that looks a lot more like European nationalist parties than it does traditional Republican issues about limited government, free markets, and so on. So many of those traditional things, and certainly on cultural or moral questions, Trump is wildly out of step with what was seen as the main positions of the Republican Party.
Do we have, going back to the Sanders Clinton race here, do we have hard evidence that minority voters are going to go for Clinton in a large way, that South Carolina, Sanders can't possibly win, nor can he win Nevada because minority voters will not break for him? Jill?
Well, I'm looking at some polling of South Carolina right now, and Clinton, let's see, in one from late last month, two from late last month, she's up by huge double digits, 37 points in one, 22 points in another. The Clinton family has such deep, deep, longstanding ties to minorities, dating from before her husband's presidency, even dating from his days as Arkansas governor and hers working for the Children's Defense Fund. I mean, they've just got very deep roots. And so I don't think that Bernie Sanders is necessarily unsympathetic or unappealing, but it's just that they have a huge head start, and people have no reason to desert them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm talking about the Clintons, both Clintons.
But then when you move into Midwestern states, Sanders seems to be pulling pretty well in Wisconsin, and so does Trump.
Yeah, I think that there's a kind of a Midwestern appeal for, you know, a Midwestern attraction to Mavericks. And Sanders certainly fits with kind of the Ross Perot mold and some of the, like a John Anderson type person to go way back.
Mm-hmm.
I would expect him to do well out there, but I still expect Clinton to hold her own. And also in Nevada, which is one of the next contests coming up.
It's hard to imagine, should Trump be the nominee, play this out for us if you would, Dan. We've heard so often on this show that the Republican Party just has to attract more minority voters, particularly Latino voters, or they're just not going to be able to win the presidency, maybe this go around, and certainly in years ahead. The vote's too important. The Republicans have not reached out to that vote. Trump, on the other hand, has lambasted those people to a point where it's hard to imagine anybody voting for him who's Latino or Latina. What does the Republican Party do about that? How are they strategizing about how they could possibly win should he be the nominee?
I don't know that the party has gone that far. The party itself, the Republican National Committee, put out a detailed study and report after Mitt Romney's loss in 2012, laying out a broader strategy to widen their appeal to a multiplicity of groups, and especially Latinos. Trump's insurgent candidacy obviously flies in the face of all of that strategizing and planning. Now anything that's done is really would be on the fly, and it would certainly hurt the Republican Party with those constituencies, and there's probably no way around that. His candidacy probably to date has already done that.
We welcome phone calls. We have some of them coming in right now, and we welcome others. We're talking about the New Hampshire primary last night. Record turnout. The Secretary of State of New Hampshire predicted a record 550,000 ballots, representing 62% of the Granite State's registered voters. Projected split, 282,000 Republican ballots and 268,000 Democratic voters. We'll ask our guests if they think those are significant numbers. The previous record was 530,000 votes, and that was in the year 2008. What do you make of yesterday? Tomorrow, it's a big political week here, because tomorrow night PBS is presenting the next Democratic debate here in Milwaukee, which will be broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. Scotty and I will be attending that and gathering information and passing along our observations to you via various forms. What do you think about yesterday? What do you think about Donald Trump? He won big last night. Bernie Sanders won very big last night. What does it mean about all of the other candidates? What does it mean about going forward? Are these just states that are small and white, and it doesn't make much of a difference that Clinton will go on to do well. But what about those more moderate Republicans? Will they, as people drop out, Christie expected to today, will those votes go to somebody other than Trump? Could Trump be the nominee? Well, we'd love to hear from you. And here's how we hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Please leave your comments there. We'd love to read them after the show or during the show. And if you like us while you're there, then you'll know what other shows are coming up, some of which you simply don't want to miss. We're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we are talking politics once again, as I imagine we will for quite some time now, as we're in the thick of this presidential campaign. Jill Lawrence is with us, award-winning journalist, commentary editor of USA Today. Dan DeSalvo, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, associate professor of political science in the Colin Powell School at the City College of New York. And let's go to phone calls. We start with Steve in Danbury. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for letting me join the conversation.
Sure.
I see Trump as a massive id, and Bernie has a massive superego, and I think voters will ultimately settle on a whole personality somewhere between those two poles.
And who would that be, Steve?
Well, I know it's popular to bash Hillary right now, but I guess that would be my guess.
Mm-hmm. And on the Republican side?
Well, I imagine they probably will ultimately either nominate Trump or Cruz, but I don't think either of those candidates are viable in the general election.
All right, thanks for the calls. Dan, you want to start with your response?
Yeah, sure. I think your caller probably reflects a lot of sentiment. I think the Republican side is still very, very unsettled as to what's likely to happen. I think many people, at least more center-right Republicans, had sort of hoped that Rubio's solid performance in Iowa would translate into a solid performance in New Hampshire. After he was antagonized by Chris Christie in the debate a couple days before, his numbers between where he was polling and where he came out yesterday were, off by about 4 points. And in that respect, the sort of center-right lane for the Republican Party really still has three contenders now, Kasich, Rubio, and Bush. And none of the three seem to be going away, and they're all attacking each other. And none of them are really focusing their fire on Trump or Cruz. Ultimately, I think the results, I think, couldn't be better for, in a way, for Ted Cruz. He's now headed into a number of states where there's more conservative and evangelical voters than there were in New Hampshire, and where he potentially is well positioned to win their votes.
And do you, either of you, have any idea what happened to Rubio with that absolutely strange response, the same response over and over and over and one more over 4 times? Was there a prompter that got stuck and he panicked and just read the same thing? Or what in the world happened? Do you know, Dan?
I don't have any specific insight into that. I mean, I think that, many of these guys have standard stump speeches. They've given them, thousands of times and under a lot of pressure. And in that respect, in some sense, you just default into repeating yourself without even thinking about it. And this was clearly a screw up on national television.
Yeah. Jill, did that kind of do him in, or will people forget?
I don't think they're going to forget. I think it had to do with nerves, because we've seen, people talk about how he sweats. Then there was the time he grabbed for the water in the middle of like a 2-minute national speech. He doesn't seem to have sort of a lot of equilibrium when he's under a lot of pressure. But I think the main thing is it really goes to the pre-existing image of him as perhaps not ready or perhaps too robotic you know, somebody whose thought processes you can't really see. You know, he's very opaque. He defaults to the stump speech, not usually so obviously, but this is a complaint that a lot of people who follow him have about him. You know, he'll get into a debate where theoretically you're supposed to be spontaneous and listening to the questions and you know, responding directly, and instead he's going to his canned lines. So that was, you know, Christie managed to do a big favor, I guess, or to some of his competitors. But Christie looks like he's going to be getting out this afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Where do Christie's votes go, Dan?
Well, that'll be a big question. I think, you know, it was never clear that there was a ton of support for Christie and many candidates from, you know, my area of the country, New York and New Jersey, have never fared that well outside of our region. Giuliani polled very well, but when it actually came to voting, there wasn't much support for him. So I think his votes are going to be, it's going to be a scrum between Rubio, Kasich, and Bush, for whatever is left of the Christie support in South Carolina and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Steve, thanks very much for your call. Claire in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Claire.
I've got two theories. I was listening to NPR this morning, the On Point show, which was also analyzing all of this, and they were talking about President Obama running as a candidate of hope, and I had an aha moment. I think two things are in effect here. One is the economy, which, as we all know, the ultra-rich are just getting richer and richer, but a lot of millions and millions of people are struggling on minimum wage jobs, et cetera, et cetera. Well, President Obama obviously won twice, but the Republicans from the get-go decided they would not go along with anything he wanted to do in spite of the majority of Americans voting for this man, and that set up the anger. So I think it's the economy and anger. And now the Republican Party is led by a man who is spewing anger constantly, and it's just ginning people up, and it's working for that reason. And meanwhile, Bernie Sanders is resonating because his message from the get-go, you know, years ago, was about the economic inequality and the problems in this country.
Thanks, Claire, for your call. Jill.
Well, there is a theory, and one of our writers wrote about it today, that what's happening now with the economy is kind of the Rust Bowl frustration and depression gone viral for the rest of the country. And I think there's something to that, and New Hampshire has been a canary in a coal mine in terms of, you know, candidates like Pat Buchanan and Ross Perot and now Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, you know, kind of a vessel for people to express economic frustration. So I think that that's part of it. I just, you know, if anyone but Trump had the numbers he has, and I should point out that he's leading quite substantially at this point in South Carolina and Nevada, the two next states, we'd say they were the front runner. We'd say they were odds on for the nomination. But we're not saying that. So, you know, it's an interesting tension about whether this frustration will be enough to actually overcome a lot of the conventional thinking among people like me and other, you know, people who've been watching politics for a long time, that this just can't happen.
Dan, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think at this point, all bets are off, and
yes.
You know, in some sense, there's a tendency to always want to try to predict the future and say who's going to win or who isn't. And it's, I think everyone, if you'd asked a year ago, would have never predicted any of this and said, "Oh, it'll be Bush versus Hillary, and it's all going to be similar. You know, everything's going to go smoothly." So, in that sense, I think we're probably, you know, humility would put us in the position of not trying to analyze exactly what's going to happen going forward. You could end up very much on the Republican side, for example, with Trump having a lot of frustration and gaining a lot of support, but given the way the primary system work on the Republican side, him not being able to secure enough delegates to actually win the nomination outright, and then you end up with a brokered convention, which, you know, we haven't had since the Democrats had one in 1968, really before the current system was even came into place. So that would be a totally unforeseen result with which there's really no historical precedent.
Many of the voters yesterday seemed to be saying, and exit polls were showing this, Jill, that many Democrats are not very happy with the Democratic Party. They may have liked President Obama, but they don't think that he did enough to address income inequality and some of the issues that Bernie Sanders has brought up. It's hard to imagine, unless Bernie Sanders got both the House and the Senate to be Democratic, how things would be very much different when it comes to governing, or even, if that matter, if Hillary Clinton received the nomination, that things are at such a state that Democrats, many of them, will remain perpetually unhappy because nothing's getting done that they think is important to get done.
Well, we're sort of having a test of that now with Obama's latest budget, which I haven't had a chance to study it in detail, but my understanding is that it does things that they would like in terms of raising funds for various projects and advancing progressive priorities, you know, raising taxes on wealthy people. It's a little bit towards the dream. But, you know, anyone who's watched what's gone on, I mean, how many times has a man tried to close Guantanamo? I mean, a lot of the promises that he made, he hasn't been able to fulfill, but not for lack of trying. So, you know, and there's a lot on the plus side of the ledger that if not at all going 100% of the way to where he wanted to go, kind of lays the groundwork for more progress later. It's just a question of, you know, how realistic do people want to be? And if they don't want to be realistic, well, you know, then try it out. But Washington is Washington. And, you know, you don't even need, all you need is 41 people in the Senate. You don't even need a majority to gum up the works. So it's a very difficult nut to crack.
And we are getting this news headline from the New York Times that Governor Chris Christie does plan to suspend his Republican presidential bid. Let's go to you on this one. Dan Samuel writes to us on Facebook, "I'm glad Kasich got a boost last night. He's the only Republican candidate who doesn't scare me."
Well, Kasich really worked hard to get his 15% of the vote in New Hampshire. He basically skipped Iowa completely. He had, I believe, 108 town hall meetings and has been completely invested almost all of his campaign resources in the Granite State. So whether Kasich can carry that forward is going to be it's going to be a real question whether he has the financial and organizational resources to go and compete in a whole big series of other states. In addition, I'd say going forward, it gets a little more difficult for Kasich in the sense that there are fewer moderate Republicans and fewer independents. Those were the groups of voters in exit polls who he did the best with. Kasich, of course, has run a very positive campaign and refused to attack any of his opponents. You know, he's been, he obviously has a lot of political experience, which is often not discussed, both, you know, in Congress and as governor of Ohio.
Let's go next. Thanks, Claire, for your call. Bill is next in Fitchburg. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thank you. Great guest, another great job. In 1994, Jeb Bush ran for governor of Florida and unexpectedly lost. He had been put forward in the minds of the Republican power brokers as the return of the Bushes after the first George W. Bush lost his re-election bid. And so when he was elected governor in 98 in Florida, it was too soon, at least under the rules in effect at that time, so he couldn't run. So the idea that the Republican power brokers have had to have Jeb Bush run for president has been around for about 20 years, and they put up $100 million on a super PAC. So I saw Jeb Bush on CBS News this morning being talked about as a guest who's got a lot still to go. Even though of the 533,000 votes in Florida or in New Hampshire, he only got 5.8% of the total vote. So I fully expect, and now that his brother, the former president, is campaigning with an ad in South Carolina, I fully expect Kasich, as your guest said, running out of money. Rubio, not ready to shine in prime time. I fully expect Bush to become the establishment, as it has been the case all along. And the hope will be then that Cruz and Trump will knock each other out through some misstep, and the votes will go to Jeb Bush, and he, in fact, will be the nominee. I'm quite certain of that. It really looks like that's going to be the case. I would expect that he would probably win the Florida primary coming up soon. So I look for it to be Jeb Bush, and while I would like it for it to be Bernie, I think it probably will be Hillary. So I think all this noise is going to come down to what the expectations were at the get-go. But your guest thoughts on Jeb Bush, please.
Thank you so much, Bill. Dan.
Well, I think your caller, you know, is well informed, and he's right that Bush and his team still have a lot of financial resources. They also can draw on ex-presidents in the form of Jeb's brother, and you know the whole Bush family network. So they've got a lot of staying power. The bigger issue, I think, the competition will come down to whether how much of those resources have to be spent to get past Marco Rubio. If Rubio can somehow turn his poor debate performance into a humanizing moment that could show him as a bright, fresh face, which you know flips the script a little bit on him being young and inexperienced. So if he's able to turn that around, he may be able to show some energy. And you know, Trump, in a way, for better or worse, had Bush's number on his campaign, appearing at least low energy. So I think that really, for who's going to win out in that, let's say, establishment lane, it's going to be how much resources are the Rubio or Bush campaigns going to have to spend to win it over, and is that going to just that's just an open question that nobody knows the answer to yet.
Go ahead, Jill.
Well, I hate to say it, but I kind of disagree with your caller about Bush. I mean, I'm looking at the Florida Republican presidential primary polling results, and Trump, who does a lot of business in Florida and has, a home or some kind of facilities down there, he has a 40% average in the Real Clear Politics average of polls, and Cruz has 19. So, you know, Bush is fourth, Rubio's third. They don't seem to have any particular loyalty to their own people in Florida. In other words, it seems like they're going the same way the nation goes. So I'm not sure that those two can look to their home state to save them, and I'm not sure that Bush can look to his brother or even his mother, who he trotted out to save him. It may be that people look at him as a possibility up against Hillary Clinton, and they just feel like he's not, you know, if they're going to have a dynasty argument against her or a generational argument against her, or even sort of a political argument in terms of, you know, they're both more or less middle of the road for their parties, he's really not the best contrast.
Mm-hmm. And talk about money. I read yesterday that he spent $35 million in New Hampshire, and in Iowa he spent $15,000 per vote. Isn't that incredible? Dan?
It is. It almost is reminiscent of Michael Bloomberg in New York City. So
yeah.
The other wild card is, would Bloomberg, in the light of last night's results of Sanders on one side and Trump on the other, see a role for a third-party campaign paid for out of his own personal fortune?
Yeah. What about Bloomberg? You want to comment on him, Jill?
Well, I think it's not very nice that he didn't tell his own news organization that he was going to be possibly running. I just don't see it. He's kind of like a Paul Tsongas type candidate, for those of you of a certain age who might remember. You know, fiscally conservative, socially liberal, very involved in gun control efforts, the kind of not the nanny state, but no smoking type things, nutrition type things, and he's just not a candidate with appeal outside of where someone, say, like Hillary Clinton would appeal.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to agree with Jill. The prospects for a third-party Bloomberg candidacy seem dim to me as well, but you never know.
Well, you sure don't ever know, do you? The truth is spoken right here. You never know. We're going to welcome more phone calls. We're talking about the New Hampshire primary, and some of you may want to look ahead. Tomorrow night is the Democratic debate, the next debate. PBS is broadcasting it. We'll broadcast it as well, and you may want to discuss what you'd like to hear said tomorrow night. Here's our phone number for this conversation. We have two guests with us, Dan DeSalvo, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He writes frequently for National Affairs, the Weekly Standard, LA Times, New York Daily News, New York Post. Jill Lawrence is with us, award-winning journalist, commentary editor of USA Today, and she was a former columnist for U.S. News and World Report. Our number is, one line is open right now if you want it, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Put your comments down there. We'd love to read them in this political season. You know, the more comments, the better, and some of them we'll use on the air. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls. Brian in Black River Falls. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Brian. Can't hear you very well, sir.
There, is that better?
Yeah, that's better. Go ahead.
Okay. I've been listening to lots of talk radio shows this morning, commenting about the results from last night. And I hear a lot of people talking about Bernie Sanders supporters being young. And they're generally characterized as either being naive about socialism or just liking the idea of free stuff. And I think that's a mischaracterization. I think a lot of these young people realize that we already have a quasi-socialist government. I mean, welfare, Social Security, Medicare, these are all social programs, you know. But we have a quasi-socialist government and a purely capitalist tax system, and the two, it's not sustainable. And I think that they realize that, and they see Bernie Sanders as somebody that is willing to take on and fix that, because either our tax code has to be changed to support our social programs, or those social programs have to somehow be, backed off or, you know, eliminated if we're ever going to, be financially sound again.
Hmm. Jill?
I was never so shocked in my life as when my two millennial children came home for Christmas and told me they were both for Bernie Sanders. They've been steeped in politics for all their lives, and I thought that they'd be more practical, but, and it was for different reasons. They live hundreds of miles apart. They hadn't talked about it, and one of them said this campaign money issue was driving him, special interests, and the other one said, the healthcare system. He wanted single payer. So, I mean, there's reasons for what they're doing. Their decisions should be respected, but, all of that said, they haven't, they don't know Washington as well as some of us do. Maybe that's a good thing. You know, maybe they should vote for what they really want and not for what they really would like, would think is possible. I mean, the problem that Hillary Clinton seems to face this time as well as in 2008 is she's always kind of the voice of reason. You know, celestial choirs are not going to come down and let us do whatever we want in Washington. We're not going to have compromise and agreement and consensus, no matter how much hope and change you talk. So, that's a problem for her. My view is I think the kids should just, pick who they want based on what these people are saying. And if it's an experiment, if it works out, that Bernie Sanders gets the nomination, we'll see how it plays out. But I do think at least, when you're young, maybe the thing to do is vote your dreams and not what you think might be possible.
He is, Dan, why don't you comment on this, too? He is just creating enormous enthusiasm, and the votes he's getting among young people are just, you can't beat him. It's like 83% of those who are under the age of 30. What is that about?
Well, I have to, just to add or amplify some of the things Jill said. I mean, if you think about this millennial generation that's come up, a couple of things that have really shaped their perspective. The Iraq War, which for them is seen as largely a dismal failure. So that would be kind of caution in international affairs, and Sanders plays to that. The recession of 2008, many
yes.
of these young people have lots of college debt. Sanders is promising to make college free for all. And the job market, getting out of college, many of these young people are, into their 20s and still living at home, don't believe they'll be able to buy a house and establish a family anytime soon. And in that respect, they see things in light of the financial crisis. That is, the big banks, corporations are, in a sense, buying off government. That's a standard Sanders line. On each of those three or four things, I think Sanders really lines up a lot with the experience young people have had over the last 5 to 10 years in American life. And many of them don't really remember, the negative connotations of socialism of the past. And in some respects, the Democratic debate hasn't really, and neither has the Republican debate for that matter, discussed the financial standing of any of our entitlement programs that we have on the books today, and much of the underfunding that's going on, and how we're going to pay for what we have on the books now, is a big political issue going forward, even without trying to add new promises onto that. So if you were a young voter and you're not really familiar with how Medicaid and Social Security are currently financed, more promises don't sound like something totally impossible.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Brian, so much for your call. Let's go to Tony in Tomahawk. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Great.
Good.
So much emphasis on the horse race. You know, it makes everything in our politics look like the Oscars and, you know, style points. I hope to God we don't hear any more questions about Hillary's emails or her integrity. You know, look at her 40-year record. As far as the specifics of the candidates, you know, USA Today, somebody, please print an article on the impact of, say, a person making $40,000 a year. Trump talks about cutting taxes to 25%. It's going to be completely blow a hole in the deficit, absolutely, and in the national debt. As far as Sanders, you know, he's promising to turn sand into ice cream. I mean, what has he done in Congress? He has not been vetted based on his record. I mean, he's been around. All the issues I agree with, you know, and anybody has taken a freshman sociology class would agree, you know, that we have inequality. Duh. But what has he done about it? All the time he's been in Congress, and I'm waiting for Hillary to challenge him on that. What bills have you sponsored, and how close did he get to make it happen? Because it's not going to be any different when he's, if he's the president. And as far as this, all this talk on the Republican side about Obama's national debt, my God, 80% of it is based on Republicans. They have never balanced a budget. You know, and where is the media to print the facts on this? The interest on the national debt since Obama's been president has been over $2 trillion, just the interest. You know, and so that's all factored in. Where's the truth-telling on where the national debt is? Because more than two-thirds of it is based on Republican either deficits or the interest on the debt going back the last 35 years.
Thanks, Tony, for your call. Dan?
Well, I think your caller's onto something. That is, we haven't had a lot of discussion of issues in this campaign on either side, or that much of the discussion has been about proposals or programs that are almost fantastical, whether that's Trump's tax plan, if you can dignify it by calling it that, or Sanders' various plans to give away stuff. But I think that the Sanders idea of, you know, single-payer health care, free college for all, these are both ways that I think are tapping into what many voters, as your caller mentioned, that are sort of in the middle of the economic spectrum, making around $50,000 a year, that haven't seen much increase in their take-home pay as it's been eaten up by greater health care costs, or it just hasn't grown as other costs have grown. These kind of things sound really appealing. And it's been the case where the other candidates, either Hillary Clinton or the other Republicans who've sort of tried to bring the debate back to where we are of talking about actual tangible facts. And I'd say this campaign season so far has been almost unique in its divorce from close factual scrutiny.
We have about 45 seconds. Jill.
Well, there has been a lot of fact-checking going on, particularly when people put out tax plans. I mean, it's been noted that most of the Republican plans would explode the deficit and the debt. And, I mean, I would note that on both sides, the economics seem to come from 30, 40, 50 years ago. You know, there's very few new ideas. I do think there people are talking policy. We're in kind of a horse race period right now because we have these primaries.
Yes,
and it's
right.
The first time we're voting.
Mm-hmm.
So please, please don't begrudge us our horse race for just a few days.
I know.
but I do agree that we do need more policy discussion, and I hope that happens.
Thank you both so much for being with us. It was a very interesting hour. Thanks, Jill. Thanks, Dan. Join us again, please. And thanks to you very much for your calls and your interest. Just a reminder that tomorrow night, the PBS Democratic presidential debate is taking place right here in the city of Milwaukee at the UW-Milwaukee campus. Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff will moderate the debate. And I think that these debates have been quite substantial. It'll be very interesting to see Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders after what happened in New Hampshire. And it will be tomorrow night. You can hear it on Wisconsin Public Radio. Scotty and I will be there, and we'll be tweeting what we think, you know, little tidbits about what's going on behind the scenes, and we'll talk about the substance of the debate on all things political coming up on Monday. Thanks very much to KP Whaley for producing this hour, to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News coming up from National Public Radio, and then we're going to be talking about the industry of the future. It'll be fascinating.